Good morning. Welcome to Jays Talk Plus. Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz with you. The Toronto Blue Jays got blanked against the Houston Astros. An April tradition it's turning into, it seems. And hey, it wasn't even the guy who no-hit them last night. Oof. Tonight's the guy who no-hit them last year in Ronel Blanco. Last night, it was Hunter Brown. Julia, have you ever seen, and you are maybe a little too young for this reference, the Josh Hartnett rom-com 40 Days and 40 Nights?
I've heard of it.
Okay.
Does that count?
Sure.
Am I losing points in your books here?
No, absolutely
rapidly?
Not. Absolutely not. I am enjoying the Josh Hartnett career renaissance with the M. Night Shyamalan movie that took place at Rogers Center and his episode of Black Mirror and things like that. But no, in that one, they go, I won't get explicit here, they go 40 days without something so that when they get that something, it's an even bigger deal.
Wow.
The Toronto Blue Jays are doing that and have gone 40 innings now without a home run.
Without something.
Without something. 40 innings without a home run.
When they get it, you know it's going to be all the more meaningful.
It is going to be a wall scraper that barely gets over the Crawford boxes in left field, but I will take it.
Yeah.
Any port in a storm, and the Blue Jays are in a bad storm offensively right now. They got three base runners last night, two hits and a walk, zero extra base hits. They struck out 11 times. It was pretty ugly, and we can acknowledge that Hunter Brown was really, really good.
Yes.
We set it up yesterday. He's having an awesome start to the season. 24 scoreless innings in a row now for him. But, geez, the Jays just can't get anything going.
Watching the game yesterday, I obviously haven't done this for a very long time, Blake, and I've never done it by myself. But watching the game yesterday, I couldn't help but think, wow, these are probably the games that make Blake go, thank God, I have a co-host now.
Well, I feel that way about having you as a co-host every show. But yes, especially because, so like one of the things, and you've covered baseball for a number of years, so you know this, but one of the things that you will start to feel on the show is sometimes the days can get a little repetitive.
Yep.
And on one hand, it's like, okay, well, yesterday we talked about how weak the offense is, how light hitting it is. Prescient, right? Like that was the story again last night. But it will, you know, if they continue to be 29th in home runs, we will start to feel a little bit like a broken record. But hey, they're 29th in home runs. They're still talking. Here's a home run stat for you that is even worse than the 40 innings without a home run.
Because
40 innings is like four games and change. Like, okay, maybe it happens over the course of the season. Andrés Giménez leads this team in home runs.
Right.
He has not hit one in the month of April.
It's April 22nd.
It is April 22nd. His last home run came on March 31st, and he still leads the team in home runs.
Yeah.
By the way, he was a light to medium hitting middle infielder, not a slugger by trade.
Right on. And yeah, that's, you know, part of the reason why we saw him drop to number five yesterday. And you can tell me that it's tactical and it's because the Astros have a ton of lefty relievers. Sure. But it's also the fact that if there aren't some changes here, then we are going to just sound like a broken record, Blake. And the fact of the matter is that George Springer is the only guy who has hit with any sort of consistency this year. Not necessarily, you know, again, he's not raking the home runs or anything like that. But when it comes to extra bases, when it comes to making something happen for this team, and he was a merchant of chaos again yesterday, stealing two bases. I think, you know, he knew probably a little better than everyone else what was in store with Hunter Brown and how good he's been.
It was also like, I believe someone mentioned post-game, and apologies for not remembering who, but like they clearly had something on Hunter Brown's time to the plate. Like Springer got a good jump both times, stole second, stole third. If the Blue Jays could have got base runners, that was probably a big part of the game plan.
Right.
Even with Yainer Diaz being, you know, pretty solid, like a former Gold Glover behind the plate, that was going to be a part of the game plan. Springer got on first and then stole second and third with nobody out in, I believe, the second inning.
Correct.
And that actually hasn't been the Blue Jays' issue. They're actually among the league's best teams. When they have a runner on third and fewer than two outs, they actually score that guy pretty often. The situational hitting was really bad on the weekend, but overall, that's something that they've done pretty well with. In this case, it was the only time that they got a runner past first base. So they whiffed on that opportunity, and that was it. That was the entirety of their opportunities with a runner in scoring position for the game.
And listen, I don't want to be the person to make excuses, but Hunter Brown was really, really good.
It's not an excuse. Both things can be true. The Jays are in a bad way offensively, and Hunter Brown was nasty. Like I said, 24 inning scoreless streak, so this isn't happening just to the Blue Jays. The fastball and the sinker were both really, really good. The changeup was really effective. They fouled off 17 of their swings, and it's just like we talked about this with Gausman when Gausman's really on, that inability of like every swing looks defensive. The average exit velocity they allowed was only like 87 miles an hour. So other than like Vlad's rocket double play ball, nothing got hit hard. And of course it got hit hard right at for a double play.
Up until the fourth inning, this was something that actually baffled me just looking at Baseball Savant. There were two hard hit balls for a total, right? So one for each side. It really tells you, it really shows you how dominant the starting pitching had been up to that point. And it did get away from Kevin Gausman in the fifth, and we can talk about it, obviously, but it looked just so, it looked like it was going to be a pitcher's duel all the way to the end until that fifth inning. And that is because, and this needs to be said as well, Kevin Gausman is going through a little bit of a renaissance here. He is figuring out his splitter a little bit more. You make the point, Blake, of fastball velocity with him and how much that matters for when Kevin Gausman is on. And we saw that again yesterday. There was some velo on the fastball that was even a little unexpected at this point, and he's going to it more. He has a lot of trust in it right now. That has, you know, bred good things for Gausman. Yes, things got away from him in the fifth, but I don't know. I was pretty convinced that this was going to be a low-scoring game all the way to the end.
Yeah, and look, Gausman was really, really good. If we want to focus on the velocity, he touched 97.8, which is the fastest pitch he's thrown this season. He averaged 95.6, which is actually his highest average fastball velocity in a game since August 2023. So he didn't do that at all last year. And this is an oversimplification because, of course, Gausman has shown us he can be effective in the 94 range of time. But the fifth inning was, like, safely the slowest fastball velocity inning that he had. And yeah, one of them, like Paredes got to 96 above the zone, but that was such a weird one where like Paredes went the other way. Like what? This never happens. Right. What's going on here? And he kind of just like reached up there to get it. Altuve's was on a splitter that didn't get quite beneath the zone. Almost the same pitch he had struck Altuve out on earlier in the game, but just didn't quite have the same level of depth to get it down below the zone. And then, yeah, everything else that got hit was, you know, kind of 94-ish fastballs. So, you know, pretty good. It was also interesting to see Gausman in the first inning. He threw 13 pitches and 11 of them were fastballs.
Yeah.
This has been, you know, not a every inning pattern, but he is feeling his fastball to start the year.
He is. It's I go back to his start against the Mets in which, you know, he got pulled before he could face Juan Soto a third time. And Keegan Mathison sort of asked him, when you're facing a guy like that who has had, you know, your number pretty much throughout your matchups, do you try to do something different or do you just stick to what you're good at and known for? And Gausman says, listen, yeah, you want to try something new, but I'm not the guy who does that. And that really stood out to me in the way that he said that because in a way, he is the guy who does that. Hmm. We are seeing him throw the fastball more this year because that is what is working for him right now. In the same way that we saw him introduce the sinker last season, in the same way that we're seeing him throw the slider a little bit more this year.
18 times last night, which is the most he's thrown since April of last year in a game. And he got three. They only offered at it seven times,
right.
But three swing and miss. And yeah, the slider was, and I think it's probably always only going to be effective as a third, like, tricky offering to throw you 100%. Off the scent of the fastball splitter. But, you know, him throwing 18 of those is really notable. And maybe it says something about the, you know, he mentioned after the game that he doesn't quite have the shape on his splitter right now. Now, he did get a lot of swing and miss.
Yeah.
Eight whiffs on 13 swings
on
the splitter.
Can you imagine when the shape comes back?
Yeah. And you know, that depth, like I said, the one Altuve got a hold of, you compare the first Altuve at bat where he struck him out on it to the second one. And yeah, it's not quite the same splitter. So maybe he's feeling that. And that's why we're seeing a little bit more fastball, a little bit more slider. But it's good that he's able to kind of, you know, tweak and go in and out. I think I'm comfortable saying, even though he did give up four runs in that one, that was a good Gausman start. Like, sometimes you're going to have a bad inning, and then he came back out for the sixth and gave him another one to save the bullpen an inning. I was pretty pleased with that as a Gausman start overall, even with the bad fifth.
Yeah, it's kind of what we've come to expect from him too, right? He doesn't really get shaken all that often, even when he coughs up four runs in an inning. So Yeah, and the Blue Jays need it. We have talked a lot about how taxed this bullpen is, and that is pretty much what you could have asked for from Gausman in that point of the game.
Yeah, welcome back to the majors, Josh Walker, and then, hey, can you eat a couple innings and throw like 40 pitches for us? Okay, we're going to pivot off. We're going to do a little bit of Jays, but we're going to do some MLB-wide stuff too. Happy to have Eric Kratz of Foul Territory rejoin one of our favorite guests. Eric, what's up, man? Nice to see you again this year. How you doing?
I'm awesome. How are y'all?
We're doing great. Love the digitized camo hat. You are the game's number one hatsman. And of course, it's got the Jays on the front. Yeah. Absolutely. This guy, every time he's on,
that's awesome.
Julia, it's a very Jays specific hat, even if it's a minor league nod or something like that. How are you enjoying the start of season, man?
It's awesome. The season's been great so far. I mean, there's a lot of Who had the National League West the way that it's going to be, right? Who had Vladdy actually signing with the Jays? Not me.
Yeah, Eric, actually, I think that's a good place to start. I am wondering, I know we're a couple of weeks removed from it now, but what was your reaction to that deal? And what did you think of that? Two big thumbs up. Well, that sums it up.
Two thumbs up. I don't send emojis, so I have to give like actual visual content. But no, seriously, I thought, okay, from Vladdy's side, I thought he absolutely played this to perfection. His agent, everybody played it to perfection. Even dropped a little nugget back in the offseason to Bob Nightingale about Vladdy's signing with the Red Sox. What? We can't lose our Vladdy to another American League East, opponent. And I don't know that the front office really, I felt like they were going to blow this one. That's why today on our show, Foul Territory, I gave the Blue Jays ownership, who I've ripped countless times, not just on this show, but on our show too, a big hero. Like, they were a hero so far for this season, not just for the Jays, not just for the Jays fans, but for baseball. I think they're bringing value back to the game, not just in a young superstar player, but in a position that since Prince Fielder got his $200 million contract, first base has not been valued. There's no real defensive metric. I think Christian Walker has been the best defensive first baseman, and he, like Andrés Giménez, has already eclipsed his outs above average as a second baseman this season already. Like, first base is just not valued enough. And so I think Jay's ownership said, you know what? We have a tough time finding or signing the Judges, the Shoheis. We couldn't woo Roki out of LA. We're going to get the guy that was born in our country. He was born here. He is the native son. And so to me, I think more teams should do this, because I think guys should play with one team. And so my hat's off, not literally because I'm bald, but my hat's off to the Jays ownership.
Well, that's great. It's a helpful perspective. And yeah, the Prince Fielder deal, I kept coming back to it when the numbers were getting kicked around, because at the time everyone was like, this is a crazy contract. Look at the annual value. And now, like, if you paid a really good hitter like $22, $24 million, you're like, yeah, of course. Like, inflation over the 14 years of this deal, $35 million a year might not seem that crazy. And for those who, like some people have been like, oh, well, Prince Fielder, he fell off. The deal wasn't worth it. He had, like, multiple neck surgeries. That was not a, like, hey, performance decline. You look at other guys like a David Ortiz, who peaked, 2 years from where Vlad is now. If you're looking for similar position and player types and things like that, there are even Miguel Cabrera lasted pretty well into his 30s as a high-end hitter. Now, Eric, that aside, this has not exactly kickstarted the Blue Jays offense so far. They are 29th in home runs. Only Kansas City has hit fewer home runs. When you see that team-wide, and it's been a month of the season now, look, this is not a team that on paper looked like they were going to be a top five home run team, but to be stuck on 12 home runs, Andrés Giménez is your home run leader and he hasn't homered in 3 weeks. What do you make of that when it's a team-wide thing?
Maybe it's the approach, especially when you look at it from a 30,000 foot view of, is that a team approach that we're looking to put the ball in play? Their strikeouts are way down. So if it was opposite and they were the best home run hitting team, and the strikeouts were the worst. You know, they had the most strikeouts in the game. People would be like, they strike out too much. We have to stop. What is this game coming to? So I think they have an approach, and I think that approach is really centralized around a guy who has kind of struggled the last few years. And he's technically their most productive hitter right now in George Springer. George Springer came over from Houston as a walks as much as he strikes out kind of guy. So to me, I think the power is there to be a middle of the road power team. I don't think they're going to be 29th, but I also think that George's approach at the plate is really something that I think the team can feed off of. And that's why when they signed him, I love the signing, and it hasn't worked out. I think he's almost got like 1,000 OPS right now. He's leading the team in that. Vladdy's going to hit his 30 homers. Bo's going to hit his 10 to 15, maybe 20 since it's a free agent year. But their lineup on opening day had Andrés Giménez in the four hole. Like, it's kind of like when I watched the Pirates play the other day. They had Enmanuel Valdez playing first, hitting fourth.
Yeah,
you're not going to hit a lot of home runs when that's the case. And not always does home runs need to come from the fourth spot, but I think the lineup is constructed differently. So I'm not super concerned. When I'm back on here in July and they're still 29th, okay, then I'll be full concern meter. But the Rogers Center, just ever since they made the renovations, it's not that Jose Bautista, Edwin Encarnacion home run park that it used to be, and that's okay. They're built on defense, and to me, when you're built on defense, kind of like the Giants are right now in San Francisco, you got to be able to play D, and they're getting Varsho back soon, and you also have to be able to put the ball in play and make stuff happen on the bases, which I think he'll do once he's back.
Yeah, and, you know, Varsho potentially back as soon as this weekend, if not then next week. Now, the Jays don't have a hitter as hot as Jung-Hoo Lee like the Giants do, but, hey, you can make do. You mentioned Springer there and some of the changes. So Springer, you know, had a down year last year, started off really poorly, figured some stuff out, closed really poorly again. He's 35 years old, and you kind of alluded to it. The strikeouts are up this year, but he's producing pretty well. When you see that from a 35-year-old guy, to you, does that say, hey, he's, you know, trying to guess right, trying to get out in front a little bit more, and he's willing to accept a little bit more swing and miss because that's his best path to doing some damage still at 35?
I think so. I really do. I mean, I think only he can say, do I feel like my reactions are down a tick? Like, I don't think, I looked at his bat speed metrics. They're not like excessively different than they used to be. It's just that reaction time. You usually run into about 36, 37 years old. Some guys age differently. My guy's been playing on the turf for a little while, so his body's going to age differently. And the difference is, like, the dude's hitting 340-something, I think, right now, 330-something. I think as an older hitter, you alluded to Big Poppy. George Springer's not Big Poppy. But as an older hitter, you learn to make those adjustments based on how your body is reacting to things now, not how when you first came into the big leagues and you were like, I'm going to play. I'm going to run through a wall. Like, he's always played with tons of energy. How he gets the bat to the ball will change during this age, during this, you know, 3-year span. And you know what? He's hot. Stay hot.
That said, I don't think he can be your main offensive contributor all season. I don't think that's going to work out. Although it was last night, especially, he was one of the fun moments for one of the fun parts of the game for the Blue Jays, stealing a couple bases. Like you said, Eric, a ton of energy there from George Springer still. I wanted to touch on one more Blue Jays thing, and it's not because we're still mad about it, okay? It's just that we love mess.
I was never mad about it.
Wondering what you saw from that Jose Berríos-Cal Raleigh interaction, you know, as a former major leaguer and whatnot. And yeah, what do you make of those little spats there again, especially against a guy who has killed the Blue Jays in the past?
Yeah, he shouldn't be yelling at Cal Raleigh. He should be yelling at the other guys who are giving Cal Raleigh the signs. I think Cal hit his 11th home run against the Blue Jays. Like, every time I watch a series with the Jays and he's in it, all the announcers, they're always said, Dan Schulman's like, Can't get this guy out of the country soon enough. Can't get out of Seattle soon enough. He just kills them. You know what I'd love to see, though, as an ex-player, because this was happening all the time before they ever made the rules, after the Astros stuff. This is always going on. And the teams, when you start seeing your team not doing this stuff, what Jose Berrios did, then you're like, are these guys not really caring about winning? Berrios wants the edge. Everybody's looking for the edge. Talent level is here in the big leagues. Yeah, there's superstars. Vladdy's a superstar, so he's better than a lot of other guys. But the talent level's right there, and you're competing every single day for an edge. And if you think a team is getting an edge by leaning this way for a fastball, leaning this way for a heater, like all that stuff, you're looking for it. The other part of it is, and this is where the Jays need to like just pump their brakes, teams that look for people sending signs in are also sending signs in. They're not, you know, because you're looking for that advantage. He's not getting it from the signs because they do the whole like beep boop beep boop beep boop boop fastball, curveball, you know, all that stuff on the little pitch comm thing. But you're picking up tips from Alejandro Kirk. You're picking up tips out of his glove. I love it from both ends, but we don't need to make a big deal out of it. You need to realize what's going on in the background, saying the Blue Jays are probably trying to send signs in too if they notice it from other people. And I love it that Berrios is willing to call out a dude that is on the other team. Like, he's not afraid. He wants to win.
Yeah, I like it. It's look, and it takes a lot to get Jose Berrios fired up like that. So obviously he thought something was going on there. But yeah, it's always funny when these things come up in like the pitch comm era, like you said, where it's like, how much could you really steal? Like, how much can Kirk give away with it, with how he's setting up, or, you know, Berrios just showing a little grip behind his back or something like that. It's fascinating that, you know, guys are that good when you're on second base that you could pick that up, signal it, the hitter can process the information, and you know, in this instance, the guy got out. It didn't actually work out, the one Berrios was mad about. But I still find it fascinating. That, and I don't know if you've caught this, but the Braves don't use pitch comm unless a runner's on second base. They are still going with the signals. What do you think of that?
I honestly, we haven't had a Brave player on, but I can't wait till we do because I want to ask about that. Because my conspiracy theory brain goes, does that mean they've hacked into PitchCom and they're like, we can listen to? I don't think that's happened, but like my conspiracy brain just is like, there could be something there. Maybe they like the flow of it better. Mm-hmm. Maybe they like the flow and the timing for their pitchers. Listen, their pitching coach Kranitz is awesome. Very cerebral thinker, very like aware of what mental aspect and the timing of pitching. It starts when you're getting the sign. It starts when you're like, because some guys, you know, they're just like, they're getting on the mound, they're doing their stuff, and they're like, no, you know, they're already going through the pitches. And then when they come set, it's almost like a foregone thought that, oh yeah, we're coming set. This way they're coming set, they're looking in for the sign, yes, set, go. You know, so I think it could be as simple as that, but I would love it if it's the other conspiracy that people are hacking into the pitch dump.
That would be, you know, there will be a book about that at some point and how they did it. But yeah, I didn't realize I missed it until you see it. And then it's very like you're playing catch in the backyard and you see the catcher putting down just the one. Hey, it gets shaken off. Okay, here's the three. Give me the splitter. That element of it was just fun for me to see as well.
On a pitch timer era too, which is, right? It just makes it all the more impressive that they're actually getting those signs down
Chris Bassett
in time.
Tonight, not sure he could go through the whole progression. He's got to just call it on the pitch comm given how many pitches he's throwing.
Not a chance. Chris Bassett is the shake-off king. He might have neck surgery as much as he's shaking off. I joked about it on this show the one time. He's got the pitch comm on his glove or on his waist, and he's like hitting it and going, nope. Like he's shaking himself off. It's incredible, but that man is throwing the rock right now.
He is. He's doing extremely well. And another starting pitcher that has dominated was the one we saw yesterday in Hunter Brown, 24 scoreless innings. What are you seeing from Brown right now? We got a good look yesterday at just how nasty this stuff is, but he looks like a pitcher who has put it all together.
He came up with confidence. Now he's getting the results from that confidence. You see a guy who, to me, he went through that Blue Jays lineup with very little stress. Like, I know he had some base runners, and you're showing the sequence here where he had to, you know, get some big outs with a runner on third. But that was early in the game. Like, they didn't really push him to the limit. And that's when he dialed it up. Like, it's pretty gross. Like, when you see a guy throwing certain pitches before two strikes, and then he goes, ah, yeah, two strikes, we'll see you. And it's just, it's an extra level pitch. I'm not saying it's Verlander, because he's drawn a ton of comparisons to Verlander, but it's that approach of, I can mitigate my way through the lineup, and then I can absolutely just rip through you when I need to, when there's a runner on base. Like, that's what the elite pitchers do. That's when you take it to the next level, that you're giving the batter a different at bat when there's runners on base than when nobody's on and your team's up by a run or two.
Yeah, it was a terrific night for starting pitching generally. You mentioned the pitches Brown's throwing before two strikes. And then there's Max Meyer in Miami, who I believe it's 22 consecutive times when he's gotten the two strikes, he's gotten the guy out. It's ridiculous. And then I know you guys did a lot of Mets stuff on the show recently. And then Tyler McGill throws another beauty one last night. Francisco Lindor gets two home runs in that game. The Mets now tied for the best record in Major League Baseball, and this is without Juan Soto looking, you know, he's just regular good so far, not Juan Soto good. How good should the Mets be feeling right now?
They should be feeling great. And I asked Tim Healy yesterday on our show, is this enough of a sample size to say that David Stearns brought over what he had in Milwaukee? Is their ability to find diamonds in the rough, kind of, or like get the most value out of pitchers because of last year, what they did with Severino, how they helped Manaea make that change, and now what McGill's doing right now. Like, you sit there and you go, is this enough? Is this enough? Because they have the best team staff ERA in baseball. And it's not just starting rotation, it's the entire bullpen. The entire bullpen, I mean, Max Kranitz, like, are you serious? Like, this dude just came out. I think he had before yesterday. Now, he gave up two of those runs that Edwin gave up on the home run were his. But before yesterday, he had a 0.05 whip. So he was giving up every inning. He was giving up a half a runner. I'm not sure how that happens. Maybe that's like loonies and doonies or something. You put like half a runner on base, but I'm not sure. But anyway, he's just not giving up any base runners. So the approach is, we believe in your stuff. Go and get it. And I think McGill last night, I think he might have some regression just because I don't think he's going to have a below a 2 ERA for the season. But I think that comes from the fact that his stuff plays in the zone, and I think he nibbles a little bit too much, and there's a lot of walks in there. But 10 punchies against a very good Phillies lineup who does struggle against starting pitching. So far, they struggle against starting pitching. When a guy comes in that only has two pitches, then they waffle him. So it's one of those things that you sit there and you go, okay, how are we going to make that change for the Phillies lineup? But the pitching last night, there wasn't many games, but, man, it was some fun pitching. That 14 punchies from Max Meyer, yikes.
The one other pitching one I wanted to ask you about. So in the Guardians game, and we know Emmanuel Classe had been struggling a little bit. And look, this is a Canadian show. Biggest Cade Smith fans you're going to find.
Oh, yeah.
Cade Smith gets the save opportunity. How do you manage that the next little bit if you're the Guardians? Obviously, Classe is, you know, arguably the best closer in baseball, but you've got this guy who has a season plus of track record ready to go to. How long do you think, you know, they can go with giving Classe maybe a little rest out of the closer spot here?
Man, we talked about it with Devin Williams the other day too. He had some struggles early on in the season. Here's what I would do if I was Stephen Vogt. Me and Vogt were teammates, great friends. I would say, man, this is a great problem to have. I'm building up both of these guys' confidence. Cade Smith says like four words. He goes out. He's like 6'10", and he just throws absolute BBs up at the plate. Like, he looks like nobody's going to hit him. Right now, Class A's getting hit. Guys are not pulling off the ball. Guys are not getting, you know, they're not getting blown away in big situations. They're taking their hits the other way on that cutter going away. I'm still having him as my closer. But man, is it good to have two closers. Yeah. So I answered that by not answering it, in the sense that he is a good pitcher and you have to make sure you know, or he knows, that there's comp, that there's, we have confidence in you. Because last year he blew a save and he posted on Instagram a picture of his, I think a picture of his like role, his Mariano Rivera award and some other award. And it was kind of like a, guys, you know I'm good. And so maybe that confidence was a little bit drained. But to me, everybody wants Emmanuel Clase in the game. He hit a little bump in the road, and as Charlie Manuel, my manager in Philadelphia, said, water levels out. So when water levels out, Emmanuel Clase will be back, and the Guardians bullpen is just an absolute joke. They're so good.
And you mentioned the benefit of having two closers. They go to Cade Smith last night. Boston can go to Justin Slatten, so they can use Chapman in, you know, the meat of the order in the eighth. San Fran's using Camilo Duvall with Ryan Walker down a lot. Hey, really good to have have two options
and,
there.
And we've heard John Schneider say something along those lines with Jimmy Garcia and Jeff Hoffman there, but seldom do we get a perfect segue such as he posted something on Instagram. And I did want to ask you about social media. We have time for one more, and I couldn't let you go, Eric, without asking about Ronald Acuna Jr. tweeting out what he did about, you know, if it was me pimping a single type of thing, I would be benched. He actually was benched. Then Brian Snicker comes back and says, listen, I didn't really realize that that's what was happening with Jared Kelenic there. Kind of became a little bit of a mess, which sums up the Atlanta Braves season up to this point. But what did you make of that interaction? And just, you know, social media, man, it's kind of showing what it can do here. Its power a little bit more recently.
For sure. Well, first of all, it overshadowed the fact that they swept the Twins, who, by the way, they're playing brutal. But anyway, I love the interaction from players. But I also have to say that coming from the point that when I was a player, I had zero social media interaction. It was nothing but a negative suck for me, because you get in there once every 5 days to play like I did. I tweet something like, great game with the boys. You know, there was people on Twitter that were, roasting me for like just saying great game, guys. Like, so I was like, it's not worth it. But I say that I like it because we are a generation, we're a society now that loves interaction. Social media interaction is the quickest form of interaction that we have right now with athletes. It makes fans feel like they know the athlete. It makes fans look less at a game and be like, wow, look at those animals out on the field. They're behind a fence. We can't even get to them. Social media gives us that access. Jazz Chisholm has gotten in trouble for getting thrown out of the game and reacting. One of the best things that I think Fox and I think ESPN even does it is miking up players. The reason it's been so well done and so well received is because fans are like, I know that guy. I listened to him. I was able to hear what he's thinking or the noise he's making as he's running after the ball. Like, you feel like you're in the game. You make that connection. And so I said it on our show. I said, do we need to lax our social media ban during games a little bit? And I got roasted by some of our faithful fans, like, this was one of your worst takes. I just question it because it's everywhere. It's like saying, I have a 16-year-old son. You can't have any social media. Well, at some point he's going to be 18, or at some point he's going to be 20, and he's going to get his own social media. And if we don't, as a parent, if I don't teach him how to use it, then it could go awry. It could go bad. So as Major League Baseball, this is here. This is here to stay. It's only going to get more and more. It's only going to get better and better. And if we don't teach our players how to use it, but also gain the benefits of it, how are we missing, what are we missing out on? And I don't know what that level is. And if I played right now, I would never touch my phone during a game. Like I couldn't change that level of distraction. But for Acuna, you know what? He said it with his chest. And I'm all about people saying with their chest. So it's something that was 5 years, 6 years ago. That was in 2019. That was 6 years ago. So it's stewing there a little bit. Maybe Acuna's not going to sign an extension after this long one's up.
That's a tough one. Yeah, I feel the way about like pretending players don't have personalities on social media is like how they try to be like, well, you can't have tins of tobacco showing in the back pocket of your pants anymore. It's like, oh, so nobody must be no one's doing tobacco. No one has tobacco in their mouth during the game anymore. We all know what's going on. Eric, thanks so much for doing this, man. Love having you on the show. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on again. We'll see you later.
Thank you.
Eric Kratz, Foul Territory. The Braves, by the way. Big comeback last night, fueled by Austin Riley beating out an infield single. Sparks the rally. Ronald Acuna, motivator of the Atlanta Braves. They've now won four in a row. They're still four games under 500, but they're trying.
Yeah.
They're chugging along. Although Spencer Strider to the IL now with a hamstring strain.
Ups and downs for this team, very much so. But yeah, sometimes you just need a spark from anywhere.
Yeah. Ronald Acuna's Twitter account, Austin Riley beating out an infield single. Poor Spencer Strider. Right? You obviously, he just came back from a long arm injury, so going on the IL sucks. But you know, for him, because of the hamstring strain, no leg day for a little while.
No leg day. That is devastating.
Poor guy. Poor guy. All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll go into a little bit more of last night's game, get a little deeper on some of what Kevin Gausman was working with there. There were a couple roster moves as well, and we got some clarity on how the Jays are for the short term, going to try to handle the fifth starter position because Easton Lucas, now a Buffalo Bison. That's next as Jays Talk Plus continues with Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz.
Big opinions and in-depth conversations covering the Leafs, Jays, Raptors, and the NFL. The J.D. Bunkus Podcast. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz with you. A little nugget of information from our pal Joe Siddle during the break. He mentioned that, in that Braves series, we were talking with Eric Kratz about the Braves not using PitchCom until there's a runner on second and using hand signals instead. Grant Holmes and Sean Murphy saying they like the flow of it better, which, I could see. It's more of a communication thing than just like, I don't know, it's like ordering your coffee from the person instead of just ordering ahead, I guess.
That's a pretty good comparison. And, you're not going to see it a lot. You're not going to see many teams do that, but it works for them. And, you know, most importantly, nice to hear from Joe Siddle.
Yeah, of course.
Very nice to hear from Joe. Thank you so much for texting in. That's lovely.
Yeah, he'll be on the show at some point, I'm sure. Okay, so we spoke to Eric Kratzer for a little bit. We had touched on some of the stuff in the game. Jays lose 4-0. They don't have any home runs. Shocker. I did pull one number, by the way. So the graphic was going around last night during the game that they were first in home runs in 2021, then 7th, 16th, 26th, and 29th. I went and I looked at the projections for each individual Blue Jay for the remainder of the season because the projection systems, they're not everything, obviously. They will account for the first couple weeks, but they're still going to be pretty heavily rooted in what has this guy done over the last couple of years. So this is the Fangraphs projections. They would project the Blue Jays to hit 152 home runs the rest of the way.
Right.
That's better than what they've been doing, but it would still leave them at only 164 for the year, which would have ranked 24th last season. So right around where they ended up last season. So even if we're saying, hey, guys will turn it around. Anthony Santander still got 30 in him. Vlad's got 25 in him, etc. Even if we are optimistic about that, Dalton Varsho is about to come back. He's included in this. Still not a team that profiles to be even an average home run hitting team.
Yeah, we spoke a little bit about that yesterday, but it is a matter of identity.
It was sobering to pull those numbers.
Yeah, was it as, I don't know, shocking for you as it was for me?
Not shocking, but you hope there's a little more juice in it, right? Like to still project, like they added Anthony Santander.
Yeah, that's it.
And you still project to be a bottom 10
team. And you have a healthy Bo Bichette who is not going to, you know, hit 30 home runs necessarily, but who is a guy who is expected to give you a little bit more pop. And Vladdy seemed to have figured something out in the second half last year. And now we're kind of back to the regression that we saw from him last season as well around this time where he's hitting for average and actually hitting the ball hard, but he's unable to pull or to put it in the air, right?
Yeah, and it's a weird thing where, like, Guerrero and Santander are going to hit their home run. Yeah. It's going to come around. We did this with Vlad last year, and you know, his underlying stuff right now is even stronger than it was last year when, I think, first week of May, his OPS was sitting around 650 or something like that, and then he turned it on. But, yeah, it's even if guys, you know, that idea that even if guys start to find their form and play to type, it's still not going to be, you know, we're talking about it's going to be an average power hitting team, like, at best.
And the thing is that you need to actually figure it out while you're still above 500, while you're still, you know, keeping somewhat pace with the Yankees and, here come the Red Sox, who are now ahead of the Blue Jays in the division. That needs to happen before things get out of hand like they did last year. It was great to see Vladdy hit as many homers as he did in 2024, but most of them didn't matter, let's be honest. So, yes, the Blue Jays are still finding ways to win games here, but that needs to turn around in time. And listen, we've spoken about this as well. The schedule has been brutal, absolutely brutal. The starting pitching that they're facing is really, really good starting pitching. They have not faced yet teams who are not expected to make a playoff run or things along those lines. This has been a very tough schedule for them. That said, things have to turn around because guess what? You're going to get to October. You're going to face these guys again, and you need to find ways to win. Otherwise, you're kind of stuck in the same place that we started here.
Yeah, it's tough. By the way, you mentioned the, like, oh, the home runs came at a time that they didn't matter. And Vlad's not in control of that. But unfairly, in my head, though, I consider those Michael Saunders home runs. And this is no offense to Michael Saunders, great Canadian player. But one of the worst Blue Jays games I've ever been to was 2016. And I was on a first date, which is, this is not a great idea for a, it's too much for a first date. The game lasted 3.5 hours. Uh-huh. It was a really bad R.A. Dickey start. They lost 14-5 to Seattle. And all I remember about it, other than that, is that Michael Saunders hit two home runs, like, when they were already down by like 10.
Yeah. In Brazil, we call that Oscar's goal because of the 7-1 defeat to Germany in the World Cup. And, you know, Oscar just scores a goal in garbage time to make it 7-1. That's the metaphor in Brazil. So, you know, since we're depressed anyway with the offense, might as well throw that one in there too.
Okay, we got a couple notes to hit from this one. So we found out the Blue Jays' plan for the short term with the fifth starting spot. Now, we had heard on Sunday, it sounded like from John Schneider, they were going to stick with Easton Lucas. They didn't really want to overwork the veteran starters and things like that. That plan is at least changing for a little bit. Easton Lucas was optioned to AAA Buffalo. Josh Walker was recalled, which was an interesting one because they now have a lefty-heavy bullpen, and the Astros are the most right-handed heavy team in all of baseball. Yordan Alvarez kind of their only real threat from the left side. However, the Blue Jays are out of recallable guys who are on the 40-man roster right now, except for Jake Bloss. Everyone who's been optioned down, you know, has to wait the requisite time unless there's an IL move, et cetera. So they didn't have a ton of options. Josh Walker has also struck out a lot of guys. So maybe some optimism there. He was just kind of asked to eat it yesterday. I'm not going to look too much into how he did in that one. But what it tells us is that they're going to use the Thursday and Monday off days to skip their fifth starter once. It sounds like they're not going to do that multiple times. They could, if they really want to go as far as May 3rd without using a fifth starter. What they'll do instead is roll the guys over. And if you were going to do it, doing it in a spot where you don't have to use a fifth starter or a bullpen day at Yankee Stadium on the weekend probably makes some sense. It's probably the right week to do it.
Yeah, it probably makes some sense. I don't like it at all. I don't like it. It's pretty unbelievable that this is where we are
again
in April, because, you know, I get it. It's been done before. These guys have done it in 2023. They did it again last year. They are asked to step up, and they do, but it's very early in the season, Blake, and these guys are not as young as they were in 23 and 24. And when every game matters and when you're relying on your pitching to keep you in the game pretty much every night, you're going to need these guys to be fresh. And these extra days of rest, they do make a difference in a long season. So I don't know. I don't know if you're as against it as I am, but yeah, it might be a situation where the Blue Jays are just making, you know, the best out of a bad situation. It's just really, really telling that we are already in a bad situation.
It is. And it's worth mentioning, too, like the three veterans that you're talking about, Brios, Bassett, and Gosman, yeah, have done this. They are a little older. There is potentially cumulative fatigue. It's also worth keeping in mind that Bowden Francis has never had a full season as a starter. He did in the minors. He pitched 142 innings in the minors in 2019. He pitched 132 innings in the minors in 2021. So he has had that. But last year, even across levels, he only threw 123 innings. So to be like, hey, he's going to be and it's not short rest. It's regular rest. You're just not getting the extra day in there. You know, something on the radar with him as well. Is he going to be a 200 inning guy his first time as a full-time major league starter? That's something you'll have to be aware of as well. Now, there are some spots later in the year you can maybe, you know, hey, Jake Bloss comes along, someone comes back from injury, suddenly your six-man rotation to buy an extra day here and there, but that thins out your bullpen. And so yeah, not great to be in this spot right away.
Yeah, it's interesting to think about, you know, down the line you could have six starters when the Blue Jays are struggling to put five starters forward right now. Do we actually believe that that will be a possibility, a true possibility down the line? Yes. You know, Max Scherzer can still come back in the second half or whatever. It sounds like he's still a ways away from actually pitching in a game. You can have Alek Manoah back and maybe he will find his stuff again. You can have Jake Bloss, you know, stay the course a little bit in the minor leagues and bring him back. These are all possibilities, but they're no guarantees whatsoever. And then are you looking at the trade market for something like that? But you also really need a slugging third baseman. You really need to add something to this lineup. So, you know, where do you go from there? Do you have enough prospect capital to make two big trades that are actually going to make a difference? I don't know. I know that I'm extrapolating and going a little bit too far, but the decisions that are made right now will impact the Blue Jays come trade deadline, come, you know, September when they're making the playoff push. And I don't know. I can't get on board with this one.
Yeah, it's also, I don't mean this alarmist, but it is like a small percentage thing that the more you work guys, the fewer, you know, extra rest days or whatever, the slightly higher chance that the situation gets even worse because someone gets over fatigued or has a short outing and you burn the bullpen, or, you know, what would this all look like if someone got hurt? Like they have had remarkable health from those veteran workhorses that they've had, which is testament to the training staff, a testament to those guys individually. But yeah, they're like, I'm 38. I know how I feel in my 30s compared to how I, you know, wasn't throwing 94. But okay, so Chris Bassett's going to get the nod tonight. That was the case, regardless of how they juggled these things. And boy, has he been good so far. 0.77 ERA, a strikeout rate and walk rate that would both be the best of his career. Of course, it's just 23 innings, but really nice to see. Great thread from Chris Black at Down to Black on Twitter this morning, going into some of the changes Bassett's made, including that he's kind of become just a four-pitch pitcher against righties. That sinker, sweeper, curveball, cutter combination. That's especially notable against the Astros because they will likely start eight right-handed hitters. That is what they do most often. And here's an interesting one. The one lefty that'll be in there is Yordan Alvarez. So Kevin Gausman, despite being a guy who has platoon splits, owns Yordan Alvarez. Right. After last night, Alvarez is 0-for-12 against him with eight strikeouts, despite being one of the best left-handed hitters in baseball.
That's really unbelievable.
Yordan Alvarez against Chris Bassett, 8-for-19 with five homers and two walks.
Oh, how do you explain that, right?
Well, Bassett has always had lefty home run issues, and Yordan Alvarez is one of the best lefty hitters in baseball. I don't know. Sometimes you just have a guy's number, I think. It is really funny to look and, like, so prepping for this one, it's like, oh, the Astros have hit 256 with a 463 slugging against Chris Bassett. That's not great. And then you take out the Yordan Alvarez part, and it's like, oh, they've hit 225 and slugged 300 against Chris Bassett. It's all Alvarez-based. On the other side, Ronel Blanco has, of course, had some success against the Blue Jays.
Some success. We all remember. And it's stuff that we're here again, and the offense is struggling again. And you know, we all remember how the year went after that no-hitter. It's tough, but you kind of hope that it's not going to turn out the same way. Obviously, I don't expect the Blue Jays to be no-hit again, but yeah, that was the series where the offensive problems became very, very clear.
Tell you what, we're having some, not fun, but we're able to put the poor offense in context so far. If they get no-hit by Ronel Blanco a second time and he comes in with a 6.48 ERA and he's having walk and fly ball issues The tone will be a little bit different tomorrow. We'll be back to break down. Thanks to Eric Kratz for joining us today, to Amit Mann, Austin Mackey, and Jennifer Rolnick behind the glass. Blair and Barker have you 2-4 and postgame. Ben Buck and Hazel on the call. Jamie and Joe with Mike Petriello on Blue Jay Central. Eric Smith with Chris LaRue and Sho Ali on the call. Have a wonderful Tuesday.